Exodus chapter 39, we've got here the account of the high priest's garments, and he had a number of layers to his garments. He had this robe, which was of one piece. It says, verse 23, that it should not be torn. And then there was the ephod, and there was the breastplate with the valuable stones on it, the 12 valuable stones. And then there were gold chains connecting that to his shoulders, and on his shoulders there were also plates upon which were written the names of the 12 tribes, six on each shoulder. People ask me why I believe the Bible, or why I believe in God, and I say the little things, all the little things put together. I don't quote any major thing. To me, it's the little things when you put them all together. If you write out the 12 tribes in Hebrew and you put six on one piece of paper, or if you like, on one of those shoulder pieces and six on the other, you'll find that the number of letters in Hebrew is identical. To me, that's just a little thing. But when you add all those, quote, little things up, this gives the impression that we get, in fact, from our own lives, that God is in this. And indeed, God was in this. Let's move on then to the untorn robe, the robe that should not be torn. Of course, this is alluded to in the death of the Lord Jesus, where he had this robe that he wore that was made of one piece. And when they crucified him, the soldiers said, well, let's gamble for this. Who's going to get it? It's a bit of a shame to rip it. Caiaphas had just ripped his robes. He was the Jewish high priest. And there was Jesus on the cross, and his robe would have been covered in blood. He put his robe back on him, or it was put back on him, after he had been cruelly whipped, which would have ripped out the flesh from his back. There would have been profuse bleeding, and there was the crown of thorns that was pushed upon his head, which meant that there would have been a piercing of that very sensitive set of nerves that are underneath the skull. And this would have produced, again, profuse bleeding down his back. So the robe would have been blood-drenched. And he would have seen in that huge significance. Isaiah 63 talks about a Messiah with blood-soaked garments lifted up in a glorious victory. And, of course, in Leviticus 8, the priests began their priestly work with their garments sprinkled with blood. So then, there's the Lord Jesus, and there he is on the cross, his moment of apparently ultimate loss, ultimate defeat, and everybody saying, can't pull a miracle now to save yourself, can you? This is the end. His disciples had fled, and it seemed that the powers of evil were in ascendancy as they mocked him, come down from the cross, that we may see and believe. And there was his blood-drenched robe at the foot of the cross. And the soldiers are deciding whether to tear it. And they say, no, let's not tear it. We're not going to tear it. He'd have overheard their crude conversation. Let's gamble for it. Who's going to get it? And he would have taken out of that a huge encouragement. And this is typical, I think, of how in some of our lowest and hardest moments, God gives you encouragement. He would have seen, out of all the awful things being done to him, leading to his blood-drenched robe, wow, this is fulfilling. This, that, and the other. This is Isaiah 63, Messiah with blood-drenched garments lifted up in victory. I am the high priest. There on the cross he interceded for us, and his blood-drenched clothes were not to be, or robe, was not to be torn. Wow, I am the high priest. Caiaphas has torn his robe, but my robe is not going to be torn because those crude fellows just, what, a meter, 2 meters at the most beneath me, whose conversation I'm overhearing, have said, "Nah, don't rip the robe, it's made of one piece." Wow. Verse 23 of Exodus 39, I believe, came to his mind. Talking about the robe, it should have a binding around its opening that it should not be torn. And he would have understood that he was the high priest. And so, as I say, this is a hallmark of God's dealings with us, that at your lowest moments, you find that encouragement. I give you one of multiple examples from my own life. I was staying at a hotel here in Latvia at a point when it really seemed my chips were not just down for a bit, but permanently down. And the hotel was in the countryside, just off a main highway. And there was a sort of a pond and a table by the pond. It was in the summer. And I sat on the seat by this table. And I had my head in my hands and I was crying and praying and crying. And I don't know if it was a raven or a blackbird came and just had a worm in its beak and looked at me like he felt sorry for me and dropped the worm. And he looked at me as if to say, "Well, I brought you something to eat." Well, of course, I didn't eat it. But I thought of Elijah, of course. And in your lowest moments, God is there in some way. Now, those garments of the high priest were for glory and for beauty. And, of course, the robe of Jesus was covered in blood and spittle. And was that glory and beauty? They were for glory and for beauty. And yet, yes, from God's perspective, this is what Werchner called years ago the magnificent defeat. It was indeed the magnificent defeat. Sure, they apparently won. But for those who were spiritually minded, no. He was lifted up on the cross, but lifted up in glory. This was the glory of God in the way that he does things. And so there is a complete inversion. That which seems to be loss is in fact gain. And this is what Paul says, those things that were once gain for me, I counted loss for Christ. And I'll give you an example of what I mean. Baptized a man, Russian man, in a very beat up area of the former Soviet Union, and he'd not lived a great life. He'd been pretty much an alcoholic, beat his wife, had lots of affairs, lived a pretty low level kind of life when it came to moral stuff. Towards the end of his life, he truly came to Christ and I baptized him. And he was struck down with lung cancer and he was dying. And his wife left him. She had discovered that he had been having an affair with the woman who lived in the flat next door. Now, the affair had stopped some time back, but she discovered this. And she said, "That's too much for me. I'm gone. I'm out. I don't want to ever see your face again or hear of you again. You've had affair after affair, and you had an affair with that woman. They lived in a tower block, typical Soviet era concrete apartment block. You having an affair with a woman next door who I knew and chatted to occasionally." So there he was with no children. His wife had left him. There was no lift in the block. And he was up several flights of stairs in this dingy little apartment flat. And he was dying. And he didn't really have anyone to care for him. I had baptized him. And he was with Christ. He was so spiritually minded, so humble, so repentant. And he was there clinging on to his Bible, clinging on to Bible basics and stuff, and reading all that he could whilst he could, praying. I used to go to see him. And it was really as if Jesus was there. I would break bread with him, and it was like him and me and Jesus. The Spirit of Christ was there. Without doubt, he shall be in God's kingdom. He will live forever. And when he came finally to his end, and he died in his bed in that miserable, smelly apartment with nobody even to bring him food to eat, no one much to keep an eye on him, God was there and Jesus was there. His death was the magnificent defeat. The magnificent defeat, because there was Christ. There was Jesus. And there was a man who shall be a prince and live forever, ruling this earth when Jesus returns. And so it was in the death of Jesus. And so it shall be in our death, for we shall all get there sooner or later in one way or another, even if you die surrounded by devoted family and friends, the classic parting, or whether like that brother you die alone and rejected, it is all the same in the end. That is all cosmetic. The environment is cosmetic, and in the end, you know, we shall all pass this way. And yet that shall be the magnificent defeat. And so it is in our lives. Our lives also have other things which, where apparently we lose, apparently we fail. But through all these things, God is working. And as Peter says, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he might exalt you in due time.